Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 18e épisode, conférence de Jonathan Havercroft, Excuses, Politics and Pluralism.
So, my paper's a bit of a turn in a different direction. So I'm talking about Machiavelli, J.L. Austin and Jim Tully. And so that immediately begs the question, why are you doing that? And the paper, I have no idea if Jim remembers this conversation. So I was a student of his at University of Victoria. And I went there initially to work on kind of Cambridge School approaches and really kind of learn the methodology properly before kind of envisioning doing some kind of project on the history of sovereignty. And as soon as I met Jim, he's like, well, if you really want to understand what Skinner's up to, you really need to read Wittgenstein. Here's the investigations. Read the first 200 remarks by next week and talk to me. And I don't think I've moved much beyond the first 200 remarks in the investigations. And then towards the end, as I was like looking at PhD programs and envisioning possible dissertation topics, Jim suggested one to me. And he said, you know, and I think this actually catches kind of a facet of Jim's ability to read a text closely and catch things others might not see. And so I said, you know, Machiavelli never says the ends justify the means in The Prince. In fact, he never even uses the language of justify very much. But he does use this language of excuses and excusable a fair bit, right? And that was a really great, as I would say, a great catch, the ability to kind of read a text that's been read many times and see something that others don't see. And so he suggested, you know, Austin's got this essay on excuses. Maybe you could kind of put those two ideas together, right? And so, like, any graduate student who gets great advice from their advisor, I promptly ignored it and went off and did my own thing, right? So I have a very different project. And someone asked me last night, am I a Machiavelli expert? And I'm not, as we're about to find out. But I kept this idea in the back of my head, and it first started popping up when I would teach these history of political thought kind of survey class and turn to Machiavelli. And that was a way for me to kind of cut through the immediate stereotype students might have of Machiavelli in a way to kind of get students to think a little bit differently about what he's up to. And so I wanted to take this conference as a chance to work through that idea on paper. So you could think of this in a certain sense as like a 15-year overdue essay that I'm kind of sliding under the door late at night, you know, feeling a bit shameful here. And so in doing it, it also occurred to me that perhaps a bit of Jim's own philosophy on pluralism and public philosophy picks up on this idea of excuses as well. So the kind of general arc of the paper then is to look at the uses of justification and excuse and their cognates in Machiavelli's writings. And I focus myself down to The Prince and The Discourses. Then the second part of the essay draws on Austin's essay to explore basically what difference it makes to talk about an action as excusable versus justifiable. And the third part kind of makes a claim about how a greater attention to excuses fits into Jim's larger project of public philosophy and pluralism. So, because we're kind of bound for time, I'm happy to share the essay with anyone who's interested. The longest part of the essay is kind of a careful tracing out of these different kinds of excuses. And so a very funny thing happened as I was working through this paper. I stopped being a Cambridge School person. I think I accidentally became a Straussian. I kind of started like tracking each instance, and then the longer and the more time you spend reading between the lines, you start to see the patterns, and I think I got the secret message, Machiavelli. So, you know, sorry, Jim. But maybe Jim is a Straussian, right? Straussians aren't supposed to reveal they're Straussians. All right, so Machiavelli is a bit less germane to the discussion here in terms of the conference, but it's worth kind of noting at the beginning that the phrase that's most attributed to him, he never says, right? People, whenever I teach him the first day to undergraduate students, they'll say, well, Machiavelli says ends justify the means, anything goes. It's a defense of a very cynical kind of power politics. Part of what the Cambridge School has done in their recovery of Machiavelli is to play up the neo-Roman angle, but it's still worth noting that he never says ends justify the means. The closest he comes is in chapter 18 of The Prince, where he says that though the act is condemnable, the outcome could redeem it, but it's not quite justification, right? So what I ended up doing was kind of a complicated process because I'm not a native Italian speaker or a fluent Italian speaker. I tracked out the different uses of justify and justification, used cross-referencing the English versus the Italian text. And so there's justificazione, which is justification, and justificare, which is justify, and then looking at excuse in its cognate. So excuse is both a noun, a verb, as well as excusable, right? And so across these two texts, there's only three times Machiavelli uses the cognates of justify. And in none of those cases does Machiavelli justify anything. In fact, in two of the cases, he cautions the prince against something because it could not be justified to the public. The public's the place where the prince is trying to justify his actions. And the third, he simply says this is not justifiable at all. Conversely, there's 19 times where he uses excuses, and I say in about 11 of them, there's kind of some textual ambiguity here, but in 11 of the 19, Machiavelli himself is excusing an action by either a prince or another political actor. And so the excuse part is quite clearly kind of the more interesting way in which Machiavelli kind of excuses, if you will, as opposed to justifying certain actions. So kind of the key conclusions then in terms of my reading of Machiavelli is that Machiavelli never justifies any action. That action, that language of justification is always considering how publics, if you will. In two cases, the people, the popolo, the people, whether or not the prince can justify his action to his people. In the third case, it's kind of what he talks about the republicate of principality. So in the international realm, could a prince wage war? And he's actually got to have clear pretexts or clear justifications to wage war with respect to other states. So it's kind of an interesting sense of what Machiavelli is up to there. When Machiavelli used the language of excuses, it's normally linked with the language of necessity. And so this I kind of pick up here. Maybe I'm shipping back to the Cambridge School. So the classic example here is from the Discourses, where Romulus, probably his most horrific act that Machiavelli is willing to excuse, is when Romulus murders his brother Remus and his kind of ally Titus in the act of founding Rome. And so Machiavelli's argument there is that it was necessary for Romulus to do this in order to found the Republic of Rome. And so it's what Skinner calls a conditional as opposed to an absolute necessity. So the way in which Machiavelli excuses certain actions is if it's something he calls conditional necessity. So the example that Skinner gives of conditional necessity, which I find quite useful, is if it's raining outside and you don't wish to get wet, it's necessary to carry an umbrella and use it. Right? Being in England now, I kind of realize that that's a conditional necessity. You don't have to do it. Nothing's compelling you to do it. But, you know, if this is the thing you want to have happen, then it's excusable or to do this, right? So in this case, Machiavelli's normative grammar doesn't assess deeds then through a lens of good versus bad or good versus evil, which is that's quite often when we use the language of justification. But instead, he's concerned with whether or not an action demonstrates great virtu. So it's not about the end itself, but it's just as much about the skill of the actor, right? So there are several cases where Machiavelli condemns people whose deeds fail. There's also cases where he condemns people whose deeds succeed, or excuses people whose deeds fail and condemns cases where the deeds succeed, right? So kind of the classic pairing in The Prince is Agathocles, right? It's this kind of horrible tyrant, murders his way to the top, and Machiavelli's like, well, this can't be praised as virtue or skill. I never am going to defend this guy, right? Conversely, Borgia kind of does all these things and actually ends up failing, but Machiavelli sees that he has kind of great skill or great virtue. So Machiavelli's normative grammar then is concerned with not so much moral judgments about actions, but assessing the political skill or the statecraft of the person involved. Okay. So then the paper then shifts, after kind of reading Machiavelli in that way, to considering J.L. Austin, right? The philosopher, the kind of Oxford language philosophy scholar from the middle of the 20th century, and an essay by his called A Plea for Excuses. And it really is a plea. He's kind of making an interjection here into kind of some of the moral philosophy debates going on at the time with a more kind of rigid analytical bent, where he's saying that really part of the turn to ordinary language should be to draw attention to other ways in which people, other kind of grammars, if you will, that people use for their moral argumentation than simply justifications. And so part of his concern is that the focus on justifications has perhaps erased the role that excuses play. So both justification and excuses, Austin note, occur when someone's accused of doing something, to quote Austin, bad, wrong, inept, unwelcome, or untoward, right? And so it's the accusation that then brings us to this need to either justify our action or to excuse it, right? And so there's actually perhaps four possible ways to respond to an accusation. There's the possibility you could admit that you've done wrong and apologize. You could deny the charge entirely and say, that wasn't me, I didn't do it, right? You could try and justify your action, or you could try to excuse it, right? And so what Austin notes is that justifying and excusing actually involve two different kinds of redescriptions of the action, right? So to justify an action, one accepts responsibility for the action. You admit you've done it, but then you deny that the action was bad. You say, no, it's the right thing to do, right? So justification is really about redescribing the act as good. Conversely, to make an excuse means what you deny responsibility for the action, but you admit that the action was bad. So they're actually kind of opposite kinds of speech acts. In one case, you're saying the action's bad. In the other case, you're saying it's good. In the one case, you're saying, well, yeah, I did it. The other case, you're saying something else compelled me to, right? So I'll pick again with Austin's example, kind of on the field of killing and what counts as a murder or not, right? So we justify some types of killing, right? So killing an enemy on a battlefield is often not condemned as murder. Often the person who does it will justify it, saying it was an act of war, I had to do it, etc. But note that we excuse other types of actions, right? So kind of questions about involuntary acts of killing someone. So if I run over a person while driving and kill them, I could be charged with negligent homicide, but I might try to excuse myself partially by saying I didn't see them, it was dark, and offer up excuses to admit that, yes, the action was bad, my actions were horrific, but there were other extenuating circumstances that prevented me from doing that. Now Austin's point in doing it, weighs a lot of points, it's a very kind of pregnant essay. So the end part just kind of goes off in many different directions. But one of his points is that he thinks the study of excuses is important for philosophy because it draws philosophers' attentions away from abstractions and back to the everyday. It's a very kind of Wittgensteinian moment here. And in particular, a focus on excuses can clarify some misunderstandings about the nature of freedom. And so he sees freedom not as a capacity possessed by an agent, right? That's kind of the classic structure in kind of Western philosophy, at least. But as, to quote again from Austin, the name of a dimension in which actions are assessed. So he sees freedom very much as kind of located with how we describe and assess actions. And so the freer a person is, in a certain sense, the more responsible we're holding them for their actions. And conversely, excuses then are attempts to not, as he notes, an excuse will never get you out of it completely, right? So we deal with excuses from our students all the time about missed papers, et cetera, and they're not trying to get out of the act entirely, but it does try to lower the blame or lower the punishment by making a claim about how we either couldn't act otherwise or how circumstances narrowed our field of action. Okay. So how does this reflection on Machiavelli and Austin tie back into Jim's own work? The simplest answer would be that this is simply my elaboration upon an idea that he suggested to me 15 years ago when I was studying with him. Right? So back then I was primarily interested in questions of historical method, and especially the methodological writings of Quentin Skinner. And so because of this, I'm hesitant to write what Skinner would call a mythology of coherence, especially with respect to Jim, right? So i.e. to assume that any thinker had a coherent set of ideas they could expound across their lifetime, right? So perhaps this is just an offhand idea. Jim suggested it to me. Perhaps he's forgotten about it, and he never put much thought into it ever since. You know, however, I do think that Austin's argument that the study of excuses can help philosophers understand the nature of normativity and freedom in a different light has at the very least some family resemblances to Jim's work on agonistic freedom and in his call for public philosophy that enables us to, quote, think and act differently. And so I want to conclude by briefly exploring how these two themes overlap with Machiavelli and Austin. So one central theme of Jim's later work is the development of an account of agonistic freedom that draws upon recent work in public philosophy, philosophy of language, and intellectual history, drawing on figures such as Foucault, Wittgenstein, Arendt, Taylor, and Skinner. And if you wanted to push this archaeology of Jim's thought a bit further back, you could note, and I think you should, note the influence of Machiavelli's account of freedom from the neo-republican and the neo-republican freedom that Skinner draws on from Machiavelli, and the agonistic account of freedom in Arendt as well. Right? And you could also note the influence of Austin and Skinner's methodological writings and the noted affinities between Austin's philosophy of language and Wittgenstein's, etc. But I think the point at which these three thinkers primarily connect, then, is in their account of freedom. So Austin, Machiavelli, and Tully, right? So recall that Austin claimed that freedom is, quote, the name of a dimension in which actions are assessed. And so what I take Austin to be saying by this is that most modern accounts of freedom are bewitched by a metaphysics of the word freedom that has the word operate as a blanket term for individual autonomy. Right? And so Jim's development of an agonistic account of freedom has resisted this temptation by understanding that freedom and free agency do not occur in the absence of the exercise of power, but within and against specific fields of power. That is, power refers to the means by which one governs the conduct of the self and others through different discursive and political strategies. And freedom is exercised through the agent's ability to either abide by strategies or resist or modify them. Central to this understanding of freedom is the role the politics of redescription plays in his account. So he sees linguistic redescription as itself a kind of freedom or an act of freedom. And so I'll take one example here from PPNK where Jim links freedom and redescription. And so consider how he interprets the argument, if you will, between Nora and Torvald and Ibsen's A Doll's House. Right? There's always a field of possible reason, I'm quoting directly from Jim here, reasonable redescriptions, illocutionary acts which evoke another consideration, draw attention to different analogy or example, uncover another aspect of the situation, and so aim to provoke a reconsideration of our considered judgment in this and related cases. These are speech acts which exercise the kind of freedom Nora tries to practice in A Doll's House, end quote. So the act of redescribing a situation as something else in order to bring to the fore a hidden dimension of power or to contest a generally accepted way of doing things is one way a citizen's exercise agonistic freedom. Redescribing a norm is a way of problematizing a norm, and once a norm has been redescribed, then it's possible to think differently about the norm and differently in response to the norm. So to conclude, excuses are important strategies in the politics of redescription. For Austin, freedom is in the field in which actions are assessed, by which I take him to mean that one must see an agent as having some type of freedom if one's going to assess a person or an action. We do not hold individuals responsible for involuntary actions, such as a sneeze or a blink, but we might hold a person responsible for a voluntary act. And one way by which we assess voluntary actions is through our moral language, where we judge an action as right or wrong, good or evil. And excuses are a particular strategy for getting one, at least partially, out of an accusation. Excuses involve a particular kind of redescription. One does not redescribe the nature of the act for which one is accused as good. Instead, one redescribes the responsibility for the action by claiming that one acted out of compulsion or did not have a choice or was compelled by extenuating circumstances. Excuses are one way that we exercise our freedom, and in pleading for philosophers to pay more attention to excuses in moral discourse, part of what Austin was trying to do was point out the aspect blindness that much moral philosophy has given its focus on justifications, i.e. on making judgments about what types of actions in general are good or bad. And while this is one possible strategy for resisting accusations, and certainly redescribing an action as good when one is accused of doing ill is one way of doing that, turning our attention to excuses and also the other types of what Cavell would call elaboratives used in normative argumentation can show other ways actors have of contesting existing norms and practices. Okay. Thank you very much.